Jesus redefined greatness. Nowadays, if a nation aspires to greatness, then its rich will expect help and encouragement to get richer and pay less tax. Its poor will expect help and encouragement to live normal lives. Both measure greatness in terms of wealth and well-being. Yet Jesus redefined well-being, telling the rich to give away their riches and the poor to give away their dreams of riches. He talked about giving and mutuality. Greatness for Jesus was not about the pursuit of happiness. It was not about getting, expanding, and controlling. Rather, it was about giving and grace. Anthony de Mello tells of two brothers who had neighboring farms. The first brother would sit up at night worrying about his sibling. He worried that since his brother had no partner or children to look after him, yes, it was the days before Social Security, the brother was vulnerable if he should fall ill or get old. So the first brother would creep out in the wee hours of the night, take a sack of grain, and empty it into his brother's granary. The second brother would also sit up at night worrying. He worried about his older sibling and the financial burden the children could bring. That bit hasn't changed as the years have gone by. So he too would creep out into the night, take a sack of grain, and empty it into his brother's granary. And so it continued, night after night, year after year, until one fateful evening when the brothers collided and discovered the truth. Years later, when the village sought to build a church, they could think of no holier spot than where the brothers collided. Two siblings who did not get on great were early Christianity and Judaism. Following the first Jewish-Roman War of 66 to 70 CE, or in the old language, AD, the revisionist Jews who followed the way of Jesus sought to differentiate themselves from more Orthodox Jews for the sake of their own survival, lest they be tarred with the same brush with which all Jews were being tarred with by the Romans. And one way these revisionist Jews did this was to insert a fictitious villain into the Jesus story, bearing the name of the Jewish nation, Judah, and bearing the guilt of betraying Jesus. His name was Judas. Instead of the Romans being culpable for Jesus' death, they are portrayed as being manipulated by the Orthodox party of the high priests and Sadducees after receiving a tip-off from the traitor Judas. Around 88 CE, some 18 years after the end of the war, the relationship between revisionists and Orthodox had deteriorated to such an extent that Jesus' followers, the revisionists, were excommunicated from the synagogues, pushing Christianity rapidly into becoming a Gentile or non-Jewish movement. These dates, 70, 88, are important because they inform the context in which the accounts of Jesus' life were written and edited. Paul, the first writer, wrote in the 50s, before the war, and he's totally unaware of the tradition that one of the 12 played the role of the traitor. Not only is there no mention of this when Paul wrote the account of Jesus being handed over, but also when Paul described the resurrection, he said that Jesus was seen by the 12. Judas is still among them, a fact that would have been inconceivable if he was a traitor. Mark, writing just after the war, introduced the Judas story. The story grew and developed as each successive gospel was written until the fourth gospel, or John's gospel, completed the Judas portrait sometime around 95 to 100 CE, some 7 to 13 years after they were excommunicated from the synagogues. The character Judas is a composite of tales of other traitors in the Hebrew scriptures. In 2 Samuel, for example, where the king is called the Lord's anointed, later translated as Messiah, there's a story of King David being betrayed by a man, Ahithophel. It's one of those good tongue twisters. Ahithophel, who broke bread with Jesus around the table, just as Judas was betrayed at the Last Supper. Later, Ahithophel, realizing the consequences of his actions, committed suicide, just like Judas. Another example is Zechariah, chapters 9 to 14, when the shepherd king of Israel is betrayed to those who are traitors in the temple for 30 pieces of silver, just as Matthew says of Judas. Of course, the accountants in our midst probably have always scratched their heads about that. 30 pieces being a small fortune, why pay that to Judas when any street could have told you where Jesus was? As each gospel was written, it drew on earlier material. The Judas fable grew more and more sinister with each retelling, as the historical context of late first century revisionist Orthodox Christian-Jewish relations deteriorated. This deteriorating context also informs the reading today that we heard of shepherds and sheep. The one who climbs into the sheep by some other way is a reference to Orthodox Judaism. Words like thief, bandit, steal and kill and destroy indicate the parlous state of relationships. Soon after the Gospels were completed, fierce hostility towards the Jews became a primary mark of Christianity, and its intensity grew in the first centuries of Christian history. The church fathers, Polycarp, Irenaeus, John Chrysostom, and Jerome, among many others, filled their writings with a blood-curdling anti-Semitism. To them, the Jews were vermin unfit for life and Christ killers. Good Friday became a day of peril for Jews as Christians emerged from churches and cathedrals filled with wrath for what the Jews had done to Jesus, and seeking revenge by beating and killing them. The vilification of Judas continues today. I saw a news item last week about the long tradition on the island of Cyprus of lighting Easter bonfires. I think the local authorities weren't too impressed. But this tradition is well loved by religious and non-religious alike. On top of these fires, they burn an effigy of Judas. Blame, dehumanizing the blamed, and seeking revenge upon them are strong impulses, not restricted to Christianity, nor to US foreign policy. These impulses both shape and scar us. Judas is a caricature created around our need to allocate culpability and punish someone. The desire to kill and burn the memory is a desire to erase the traitorous, undesirable part of our community and of ourselves that we don't want to live with. Jesus told us to love our enemies, including the enemy within our own hearts and minds and bodies. And we need to learn and relearn the consequences of not doing so. For hate can turn into a festering sore. Blame is detrimental to healing. Burning singes our own soul. Revenge is corrosive of lasting peace. Yet loving enemies is hard work and scary. Last week, Pedro spoke of his brother's murder, killed for a baseball cap. Such psychological pain is hard to imagine. Pedro spoke too of forgiving the murderer. Such psychological strength is also hard to imagine. For those of us who haven't experienced trauma like this, we have no idea of what such forgiveness costs. Yet we sense something powerful, awesome, and holy here. Greatness for Jesus was grounded in relationships, where he emphasized the ethics of giving and mutuality, and where wealth and personal well-being took second place. Yet there is also at the heart of relationships the need to practice forgiveness, to ask it of others and to give it to others, including to ourselves. As a nation, the rich, those who have, need to ask it of the poor, those who have not, and then support policies to prove it. As an Easter people, as Christians, we need to ask forgiveness of Judas and all the other caricatures of blame that we create.